From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Richard Lattendresse, Washington correspondent for Canadian broadcaster TVA Nouvelle. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard, Michael Warren.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. President Trump says he's negotiated a new North American trade deal with Mexico. Will Canada sign on to a new NAFTA as well? The massacre of hundreds of thousands of Muslim minorities in Myanmar has leaders at the United Nations calling for action. But China and Russia are standing in the way. The confirmation hearing for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh begins next week on Capitol Hill. We'll discuss what to expect. And finally, Americans this week mourned the death and celebrated the life of Arizona Senator John McCain. The war hero and 2008 Republican nominee for president will be laid to rest at the U.S. Naval Academy in Maryland. But we'll start with new NAFTA, which the president says he's going to rename a trade deal with Mexico and Canada. Tracy Wilkinson, what did we learn this week? What happened on Monday with the president calling the president of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto? What happened? What did we learn? And where, after 18 months of negotiation, is NAFTA or a new trade agreement?
Well, we learned the phones don't work, which is interesting because we all have that problem, and they even have it there in the White House. President Trump talked about a new agreement with Mexico that excluded Canada. But even as he spoke, the Mexicans were saying something very different. So it's hard to know exactly what was agreed to. I think that Mexico agreed to several of the concessions that the United States was demanding, and I think the United States might have relented on a couple of their demands that had been very extreme. But the reality is that until they get Canada involved, the Mexicans won't go along with it. They really want Canada to be part of it. And it may be that this was Trump's way of sort of pressuring Canada to join. You know, we in our paper called it a bluff that Trump was doing in order to get Canada to act more quickly. I don't think anyone disagrees with the fact that NAFTA needs to be updated, at least. You know, it was written more than 20 years ago, and you know, before even the internet was dominant. And so, I don't think anyone disagrees with that premise. But there are key points. I mean, Trump has called it the worst deal ever, but in fact, it's been very beneficial to the three countries and their economies and jobs. And in Mexico especially, it sort of raised the whole middle class because of the jobs. So we'll see.
But this is a negotiation that's been going on really since the beginning of the Trump administration. And Richard, there were a lot of concerns that they weren't going anywhere. But what Tracy just described between the United States and Mexico, that seems to be a change, and a change that has at least calmed nerves in Mexico City and Toronto even.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, Mike,
Ottawa,
because in Ottawa. It's interesting because obviously the negotiations had reached some sort of a dead end during the springtime. So things were stalled, and even the Canadian foreign minister decided not to get involved in this round between Mexican and Americans. And suddenly, Monday, we learn about this deal, and she had, there's a sudden sense of urgency. She quickly came to D.C. from Germany, and the feeling is that something had to happen. The changes, I mean, it's interesting because indeed the agreement after 20-some years needed to be reviewed, but the changes that have been put forward are not super dramatic. I think from the Canadian perspective, what has happened since the beginning of the Trump administration is an injection of chaos into the financial and economic world. And as I learned, as I heard from the ministers of foreign affairs and the minister of economy from Mexico, this, at least this deal they made with the Mexicans, brought some stability, some quietness. The investors, the businesses, and the workers finally could breathe a sigh of relief, just because they have a deal. They want Canada to be part of it, but at least there's a way to stabilize the whole thing. I think so. Canada got involved in the hope that we would reach a point where we could turn the page and just go back to doing business without fearing that actually we have to start from scratch.
Well, this is interesting that the changes, the proposed changes to NAFTA or whatever it's going to be called eventually, really do seem to be tinkering around the edges, and really not sort of blowing up the central concept of free trade, freer trade among the three big North American countries. That's not exactly what President Trump sold during the 2016 campaign or has been arguing for. But I think we have learned, Tracy, that the president is less interested in getting sweeping change in some of these big policy areas, including trade, than he is in simply being able to declare a victory. So do you think that the United States and the Trump administration will abide what is essentially a tinkering around the edges of NAFTA?
Well, you're right. He repeatedly throughout the campaign and before talked about NAFTA as the worst trade deal ever. And but in fact, he's confronted the reality that the deal actually was very beneficial to U.S. economy, Canada and Mexico's economies. I don't know. I think that this idea of calling it now the Mexican-U.S. trade agreement is not going to fly. I think it still has to be a three-country agreement. Will he be sad? I mean, he does often want to claim victory when there's not victory. For example, you know, he resolved the North Korea nuclear threat, which, of course, he didn't. So maybe that's enough for him. And then maybe now he can let the real negotiators go back and really come up with a deal. I don't know. But I do think there are serious people seriously negotiating this. There are a few points that seem kind of insurmountable, like the sunset clauses, which the U.S. has been demanding that NAFTA be renegotiated every 5 years,
right,
which no one else wants. And so, you know, we'll see. We'll see. But I do have confidence that there are enough serious players involved that they can come up with some kind of agreement.
Including in the Trump administration, who are not necessarily allied with their own president on
Correct.
These issues
as always.
Regarding trade. As, as always, as with many issues. Well, let's turn our attention from North America to Southeast Asia, where, of course, for the past more than a year, ethnic cleansing of a Muslim minority in Myanmar, the Rohingya, has been going on. The United Nations officials there calling for some kind of action, but there doesn't seem to be any action being taken against the Myanmar government to stop what is happening there on the border between Myanmar and Bangladesh. Tracy, bring us up to speed about what happened in the United Nations and maybe what the United States and the State Department are doing to react to all this.
Well, the United Nations came up with a very damning report about what is going on there, calling it genocide, the mass killing, rape, displacement of the Muslim Rohingya, and actually naming several military leaders who should be sanctioned and punished. But that resolution has not gone anywhere. I think Russia and China have been reluctant to get on board, as they often are. And in here in the United States, while they agree that the abuses there are egregious, the atrocities are egregious, you know, we asked the State Department this week, do you consider this a genocide? And they won't say that. They'll say it's ethnic cleansing, but there are all these legal ramifications for declaring it a genocide. So they seem reluctant. And it seems to me, once again, a slowness of the international community to react, as we saw in Rwanda, as we even saw in Bosnia. So it's kind of dispiriting that the big powers will not get on board.
Well, in this particular situation, there was a lot of hope several years ago for Myanmar, and that this ethnic cleansing, this genocide, as the United Nations call it, has really blown that idea out of the water. Is that, Richard, why Western countries are reluctant to really take action on this? Is there fear about or concern about what China may do? Why the reluctance from the West, even with this really damning UN report?
Myanmar is a major country in Southeast Asia. It's a big population, a very influential. It was on the side for so many years because of the junta in power, the military leaders in power, and now suddenly it was coming back into the world community. And I think they saw Myanmar as a major player, regional player, and I think indeed China, with the new Silk Road, with its will to have more and more influence in the Indian Ocean, it was out of question that the military leaders were going to be punished for whatever happened, especially also, and it's very sad to acknowledge, but this is a case of, first, it's perceived as being within the borders of Myanmar. China does want to hear about their own way of dealing with their issues, the Uyghurs in their own Muslim minority. They want to deal with this. We have several reports recently that their Muslim minority has been suffering in different ways. In this very case, it's a Muslim minority in a Buddhist majority country. It's their business, and they want to keep it this way. So first, we couldn't see any way China was going to criticize the Myanmar government, and by extension, I think it wants to keep Myanmar in its orbit. This said, I really think that whatever the reports is damning, and the geopolitical reality is what it is. But we still have 700,000 refugees in Bangladesh, people in horrible conditions. Still, several hundred thousand Rohingya in Myanmar who are still being persecuted by the regime. So the fact is, and it's interesting, Tracy refers to Rwanda, for instance, because it's still happening. In Rwanda, we just woke up when it was almost over and we just couldn't figure out a way out of this.
Right.
But in this very case, we still have those people. And the report, it's a slow process. Tracy underlined it so well. But it's at least this report is a very concrete way to say, okay, it is there. Something has to be done.
Well, we'll be watching this this issue, and we will return with more issues to discuss right after this break.
You're listening to Issues in the News on the Voice of America from Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. And Richard Latendresse, Washington correspondent for TVA Nouvelle. Our moderator is Michael Warren, White House correspondent for The Weekly Standard.
So when Congress returns from its Labor Day break, the Senate Judiciary Committee will be holding its hearings for Donald Trump's second Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. Tracy Wilkinson, there has not been a lot of controversy, a lot of questions about Brett Kavanaugh's sort of personal life. Are we preparing for a week or two of pretty dry coverage of his judicial views and senators, particularly on the Democratic side, trying to pull out what decisions a Supreme Court Justice Kavanaugh might be making?
Well, I would never admit to dry coverage, but I do think that the Democrats, those who have wanted to torpedo Kavanaugh, have not had any ammunition. He seems to be sailing to a confirmation. What has come out about him, he definitely has very conservative views. That's no surprise. And there have been some reports about his disdain for reproductive rights, his possible rejection of same-sex marriage. We'll see. But most importantly, perhaps, is his writings and decisions about the power of the presidency, and that the president should hardly ever be exposed to prosecution, indictment, investigation. So I'm sure that's something that Trump had in mind when he picked Kavanaugh.
And we'll be hearing from Democrats sort of focused on that question with respect to sort of what's happening contemporaneously in Washington with the Mueller investigation.
The Mueller investigation, exactly. But I predict that he will be approved, and I don't think there's much doubt about that.
Right. It seems that there were questions that there would be the sort of two or three Republican senators, a very narrow majority that Republicans have in the Senate, who are in the moderate wing, thinking mostly of Susan Collins of Maine and Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Seems to be no indication, Richard, that either of those senators are seriously considering voting against their party's nominee. They both voted for Neil Gorsuch, the president's first nominee.
I totally agree. And we heard Susan Collins after her meeting with Brett Kavanaugh say, especially the fate of the Roe v. Wade decision on legalizing abortion, it keeps on coming back. But in the end, she sat down with him, and according to her, he told her that it's settled law. So what else? There's no other handle for her or and for this?
This seems to be the answer that Republican nominees in the last 20 years have been giving, that Roe v. Wade is settled law, despite maybe perhaps their own personal views about it. And that, I think, seems to be that seems to have died as a real a potent issue for moderate Republicans, of which there remain a few.
Exactly. And so that's why, as Tracy said, we don't see how Kavanaugh could avoid being confirmed or having a tough time during the hearings. This said, Mike, my feeling is that it's going to go so well that it's going to infuriate the Democratic base, the activists who are going to say, okay, the Republicans have been able to pack conservative to pack the judicial system with their nominees without the elected Democrats in Congress doing anything to slow down or scale down or make it less conservative. So in the end, I think that's the impression I have. When you look at the success that the conservative and Mitch McConnell has had to in
the Senate majority leader has had to
have his nominees go through the process successfully, I think politically, in the end, it's going to have an impact because the Democrats on the ground will say, okay, obviously the leaders we've had, the elected officials we have in Congress, they are useless or too weak to face this reality.
And I think there is an open question, though, if we consider politically how that shakes out. Will it be motivating to Democratic voters in the midterm elections just less than 3 months away? Or will it be depressing to those voters who say, well, maybe perhaps there is no use in voting for Democrats? You also have a very difficult Democratic map on the Senate side, much more difficult than the House in terms of changing the majority. Obviously, if there's a big Democratic wave, which I think is possible, maybe that won't matter. But Democrats, because these judicial nominees go through the Senate, Democrats are in a much more difficult position than if they, for instance, were going in front of the House, which a lot of observers think is likely to go to the Democrats. What's the political fallout of a successful Kavanaugh nomination hearing?
Well, I agree with Richard that the Democrats will be, you know, really upset about this because, in fact, Trump will have kind of reshaped the Supreme Court and much of the judiciary for decades. But what they must keep in mind is that the Republicans are in the position to do that because they control the Senate and the House. Right. And so unless you change that, you cannot, I mean, the most well-meaning Democrat can't really do anything about those nominations unless, you know, without a majority. And so I'm thinking that that will be a motivation for Democrats to vote, but you never know. You never know. There had been a lot of discussion about whether the Kavanaugh nomination ought to be delayed until after the midterms, so that might be an incentive for Republicans to vote. And, you know, a lot of calculation, and I don't know where it all falls out, but I think the Democrats have to keep in mind that until they can control one of the houses, that, you know, this is going to happen, and it's their own fault for not voting, frankly.
So we should mention quickly on this issue, news from the White House this week that the White House counsel, the top lawyer in the West Wing, Don McGahn, the president on Twitter characteristically announced that McGahn would be departing after the Kavanaugh hearings were complete. McGahn has been sort of a midwife for all of these judicial nominations. He's got a couple of lawyers in the White House counsel's office who are solely devoted to these nominations. And a lot of Republican senators are voicing their concern about McGahn's departure. Richard, very quickly, what does McGahn leaving the White House mean for the future of what has so far been really the Trump administration's most successful project, which is changing the makeup of the judicial
system? We'll see, because he's been very successful, Don McGahn, in accompanying those nominees to their confirmation. The interesting thing is that it just brings us to a smaller legal team around the president, and it's pure speculation at the moment, but the midterms are coming, and if indeed there is a Democratic wave, the House could fall in the hands of the Democrats, and then subpoenas and potential
impeachment.
And at the moment, it looks with a heavyweight as McGahn leaving, Megan leaving, I think the White House is at the moment not, obviously doesn't look like ready to face this wave of challenges coming from potential challenges coming from the House of Representatives. So, I mean, I think the Republicans are disappointed to see this very efficient lawyer leaving the White House at this time. But also, they look ahead, and how is this White House going to face what could be coming from the a new House of Representatives?
Yeah, and Trump doesn't seem to be able to retain lawyers. You know, he's been switching lawyers for
on
2 years.
On the private side of his legal defense.
On the private and the public side. Correct. So
we'll see. You know, yeah. Now, of course, the country and really the world is mourning this week the loss of Senator John McCain. This week would have been his 82nd birthday. He died after suffering from cancer for several months. Tracy, talk a little bit about John McCain's legacy in the world as well as in the United States, where he was obviously a war hero, shot down during the Vietnam War in a Vietnam prison for several years, and really took up the cause while he was in the Senate since the 1980s of people across the world fighting for liberty, fighting for freedom. Does he have a legacy beyond the United States that people are appreciating this sort of big giant of American politics?
Yeah, I think so. You know, he was very anti-Russia. He was very firm on condemning Russia's aggressive behavior with its neighbors, with Georgia and Ukraine. He was very supportive of NAFTA, actually. And at one point, although I think he changed later, he was very supportive of immigration reform. And so he was like any politician, where he did waver on some issues. But I think he was overall seen as someone who really represented what the United States is supposed to be about. And I think all of the accolades pouring out now are in part a way to emphasize and dramatize how different the leadership we have now is compared to someone like McCain. You know, McCain, as you say, you know, fought in the war, was shot down, was imprisoned, and then
was given a chance to leave prison early, actually,
and
did not because of protocol.
Exactly. And he was badly, you know, injured. He suffered for the rest of his life. And so all of these are values and standards that we don't see in a lot of the current leadership. And so I think that's why his death now is having such an impact, is because it reminds us of what we no longer have.
This is a question domestically, Richard, very quickly about where the Republican Party is right now. John McCain was the party's nominee for president just 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
He lost, but was very much a part of the establishment of the party. Now there's the controversy this week over whether the president was going to honor John McCain's death by keeping the flag at half staff at the White House. It was back up at full staff and then back at half staff, a sort of silliness that maybe obscures his own legacy within the world and within the United States and within the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the same Republican Party that John McCain was in for decades?
Following this closely, my impression, Mike, is that we're burying not only John McCain, an American hero, but the Republican Party as we've known it for the last 30 years. And so I think a lot of people are sad of losing a hero and sad of losing this conservative way of doing politics. This said, I think you say it perfectly right. 10 years ago, he was the face of the Republican Party and of the conservative movement. And now we look at Trump and we say, okay, Trump is now the conservative movement in the U.S. It's hard to say that it's going to last.
Where could the party be in 10 years? Where could the Democrats be? That's a big question, but I think undeniable that McCain's legacy is one that seems to be in the past now. Well, that's all the time we have. Thanks to Tracy Wilkinson, staff writer for the Los Angeles Times, and Richard Latendresse, Washington correspondent for TVA Nouvelle. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. And I'm Michael Warren, White House correspondent for the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.